My name is Jeremy Rayner. I'm the director of the Johnson Sharma Graduate School of Public Policy here at the University of Saskatchewan campus. Welcome to this public lecture sponsored by the school and by the Center for the Study of Cooperatives. It's my great pleasure to welcome you here at the U of S campus and, as you see on the screen, at the school's University of Regina campus. Our lecture this morning is on the subject of citizen energy, social innovation, public policy, and the German energy transformation. I noticed somewhere in the course of this, the development of this talk, the title changed so that we now have the translation of the German Energiewende. I see I practiced especially to say that. And I apologize to any native German speakers in the room for mangling their language. Transformation is indeed usually how that is translated. And it's my very great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this morning, Dr. Brett Fairbairn. Brett is a professor and graduate chair here in the Johnson Sharma Graduate School of Public Policy. He's also a fellow in cooperative history and governance at the Center for the Study of Cooperatives. Brett, as many of you know, is a Rhodes Scholar. Holds degrees from the University of Oxford, has held an Alexander von Humboldt Fellowship at the Free University of Berlin. He has more than 100 peer-reviewed publications to his name. In the field of public policy, he's worked with the Policy Research Initiative at the Privy Council in Ottawa on social policy and social enterprise, and with the Institute of Public Administration up at Canada. He is the recipient of the Queen's Gold Jubilee Medal for his university and public contributions, and in addition, of course, his research work has had a distinguished career as a university administrator. Please welcome Brett Fairbairn.
Thank you very much, Jeremy, and welcome everyone. As Jeremy has said, my name is Brett Fairbairn. I have a collaborator for the research that I'm talking to you about this morning. That's Professor Markus Hanisch of the Humboldt University in Berlin. And what we're driven to do in this talk is really out of curiosity. Both of us are interested in cooperatives. I have to say neither one of us is a specialist in either in energy policy or in innovation. But out of an interest in cooperatives, we became curious about what was going on with cooperatives in Germany's energy transformation and what can that teach us about the process of innovation. So that's kind of the theme of the talk. Yes, so I'd like to begin by acknowledging that I'm standing here on the territory of Treaty 6 and the homeland of the Métis. And it's relevant to consider that people have lived here for uncounted millennia in balance with climate and with environment. That's a thought that should inspire us as we consider the topic of today's workshop. What I'd like to talk to you about is how to understand energy transformation and models of innovation based on the German case. And what I'd propose to do is to give you a quick overview of some of the things that have gone on in Germany, just to establish a bit of a baseline. And then I'd like to talk about the thinking and the literature reviews that my collaborator and I have done to understand innovation processes and to consider how they might apply to this example. Having developed a bit of a model of innovation that includes aspects of social innovation, I'd like to kind of analyze in more depth some of the key aspects of the German case and then give you some conclusions at the end, probably about 45 minutes in total. So that's kind of the goal for the next 40 minutes. So in terms of an overview of the German case, one of the places I'd begin is with legislation. So the key piece of legislation that provided a framework for the energy transformation in Germany is an act of the federal parliament that's known as the EEG. I won't walk through all the German terminology, but it's on the overhead if you need to be able to look it up. And what this legislation in the year 2000 did was to set targets to increase renewable energies. And in fact, the first target that was set was exceeded, and subsequent revisions to the legislation have set higher targets. And the current target is by 2035 to have approximately 40 to 45% of Germany's energy supplied from renewable sources. So a quite an ambitious target. Since the law was passed, the actual share of energy from renewable sources in Germany has increased pretty much each and every year. The legislation required electricity distributors to accept connections from producers of renewable energy, and it specified that there would be premium prices paid for fixed periods of time for those energy sources. The financing of this system included a consumer surcharge on the order of a bit more than 6 cents per kilowatt hour, which is a substantial subsidy to the sector. And there were also contributions from taxpayers to sort of share the cost of this overall transformation. So that's one piece to keep in mind, is that there's a historic piece of legislation that has helped condition what's gone on in Germany. However, accompanying that legislation is something else, which I'd characterize here as a vision of citizen energy, Bürgerenergie, in Germany. And this is a vision not only that the state require that there be renewable energy, but that citizens participate actively in the production and distribution of energy and the transformation of the system. This vision is based on a number of key ideas. We could reference, as it mentions on the overhead, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and their fifth assessment report, which called for complementary actions across levels, from individuals to governments, in order to carry out transformations of energy systems. Within Germany, there's a very interesting report by the German Advisory Council on Global Change entitled World in Transition, a social contract for sustainability, and that terminology of a social contract is a very interesting terminology that talked about citizens' inherent rights to participate in energy transformation. So based on that kind of thinking, what we've seen in Germany is, first of all, a broad approach to citizen energy, Bürgerenergie, that includes individual entrepreneurs, small, medium-sized enterprises, and cooperatives, which is particularly my collaborator's focus and mine for what I'm talking to you about today. Within that, the cooperatives are a very interesting sector. So there are almost 1,000 energy cooperatives registered in Germany. Nearly 900 of those have been newly registered in the last decade, so since 2006. So 900 cooperatives in a decade, that amounts to nearly 11% of all the cooperatives that exist in Germany, so a brand new sector that has emerged in 10 years, and nearly two-thirds of all the new cooperatives that have been created in that period of time. So that may give you a sense of something really new and interesting that's going on. Most of them started quite small, by the way. These are grassroots community organizations. The majority had 50 or fewer members when they were incorporated, but the movement has now grown to one that has more than 165,000 individual members who are co-owners of energy cooperatives across Germany. So that's a little bit of what's going on in terms of the cooperatives. What are they doing? The great majority of them are involved in photovoltaic energy production. And the picture on the left here is an interesting one. I don't know how clearly you can see it, but that's actually a football stadium. And the solar panel installation is on the roof of the stands that the spectators are sitting in. So that's one example from one cooperative of one of their installations. A smaller percentage are involved in wind. There's a really interesting set of developments around cooperatives that are involved in biogas production and heating distribution systems in rural areas. So if you want to visualize what these co-ops are doing, maybe that gives you a quick sense of it. They are spread throughout Germany. There's a bit of a concentration in the south and the west, but in fact there are energy cooperatives in every region of the country. Again, in the spirit of a quick overview, you might also ask, well, what's the result of all this been? This is produced by the Federal Economics Ministry in Germany. It's showing the mix of different energy sources in German energy production. So since 2000, when the EEG, the new law, was passed, you can see in particular that the share of the bright red here, which is nuclear energy production, has dwindled considerably. Soft coal and hard coal, there's been some decline and change there, but in particular you can note the increase in the share of various kinds of renewable energy production. And in terms terms of production, those now exceed 30% of the total energy that's produced in Germany. And there's a color code for biogas, for photovoltaic, for wind, and for hydro that's included there. Another way to look at it is to say of that 30% that is renewable, there's the mixture that you have. In the pale blue is wind, green is biomass, yellow is photovoltaics, the dark blue is water. So that may give you a sense of, as of 2015, the latest statistics as to what the mixture is. So that's the case, a significant change in national energy production, a significant number of new cooperatives. And our interest is, what does this show about innovation? Clearly, this is a story of innovation, but what kind of innovation and what does it teach us? And the photograph here I really like. This is a traditional German village with the Fachwerk houses that are common in rural Germany. And in the background, you see the biogas installation and the solar panels up on the hill. So this is the new rural Germany innovation in their historic small towns and communities. So that's the quick overview of what's gone on in Germany. And I'll go a little bit slower through some of the analysis of it later. But what my collaborator and I are interested in is how does this relate to ideas of innovation and how innovation occurs in economies and in technological and social systems. So basically, out of curiosity, we thought, well, what's out there in terms of understanding innovation? What are some of the writers? What are some of the concepts that are well established? So we thought about that and sort of reviewed what we could think of in terms of innovation theory and what we could identify. And I think one of the places I'd begin is with an observation that Frank Haelius made in 2009, that most of the theories of innovation that were developed in the course of the 20th century focused on technological innovations and the ways in which those innovations were propelled forward by economics. So that certainly has been a focal point in a lot of the literature. So in that vein, one of the places to begin is with Schumpeter and his view of innovation as he developed it in the early to mid-20th century. And Schumpeter highlighted the role of the entrepreneur as someone who introduced an innovation. And through the adoption of that innovation by some firms, those firms would be able to lower their costs, compete more effectively, put other firms out of business, resulting in a disruptive effect or a kind of creative destruction. So that idea of the role of the entrepreneur, the technological innovation, and the disruption of industries is an important part of the literature and the subject. Schumpeter's idea of creative destruction is also related to the concept of evolutionary economics, which is a term first coined by Veblen and developed by other writers. And we've highlighted here Nelson and Winter in the 1970s. What they considered was ways in which variation occurs in firms and in technologies, ways in which variations interact with institutions in the environment that exert a selective pressure so that some variations survive and multiply. So an analogy to natural selection and variation in biology. And when Nelson and Winter thought about where these innovations come from, so very much reflecting the thinking of the 1970s, what they thought about is big organizations, governments, research labs, universities. That's what kind of produces these ideas. They get out into the economy, and then there's this selective process. There were also some writers who were interested in what impulses actually cause actors to consider innovations in the first place. And in this regard, I think we highlighted the work of Rutan and Hayami, who talked about how scarcities in factors of production would induce innovation in systems and would cause people to look for ways to address disparities in factor prices. So that inducement of innovation theory is also out there. Other writers looked at the other end of the process. When we think about how things diffuse, the French sociologist Gabriel Tarde was one of the first to observe that innovations follow a characteristic logistic curve in how they spread, and that idea was later developed by Everett Rogers, who attributed it to the propensity of different segments of the population to adopt innovations. So you had Rogers' model of a distribution of people from early adopters to laggards, and that producing this characteristic logistic curve, the light-colored curve on the graph. So that's we found a number of other things, but those are some highlights, I suppose, of what kind of is out there in terms of innovation theory up to that point in time. And I think an observation certainly for our case is that this model is incomplete in a variety of ways, and some of the writers in that period observed that as well. But in particular, when we think about this German case, these models of innovation that are based on entrepreneurs, on economically driven innovations, on things that reduce costs and increase the likelihood of certain firms surviving, none of this seems to explain very well what we see in a case like the German energy transformation. As one group of writers said, what we need if we want to understand things like the energy transformation in Germany is much more a synthesis of technological and social change. So that's then where my collaborator and I turned in looking for additional models, additional ideas to make this model more complete and more applicable. We identified a number of candidates, social innovation, cognitive models, user innovation, which are things I want to say a word more about. Social innovation is a large topic all on its own, and it would be interesting to have an entire presentation just on this subject. Very briefly, the term social innovation probably was first used by Peter Drucker in the 1980s, and he was attempting to draw attention to the fact that most theories of innovation up until that time had been focused on technology and economics. And he was saying there's something else going on. Innovations aren't always technological. In fact, some of the most important aspects of innovations may be social. So he said social innovation. In the last 15 years in particular, there have been a lot more thinkers and writers working on the topic of social innovation, and they've produced a variety of perspectives. So one that's influential was the Stanford Business School Center for Social Innovation, which came up with this view at the top, defining social innovation as a novel solution to a social problem that is more effective, efficient, sustainable, or just than present solutions, and for which the value created accrues primarily to society as a whole. So a social innovation is a new practice, let's say, a new way of doing things. And what makes it a social innovation is that it spreads and is beneficial to society as a whole. So an important point that's embedded in that is that, like the concept of technological innovation, the assumption here is that innovation is always good. You don't use the word innovation unless the outcome is beneficial. So that's part of how the discourse works here. So a social innovation is something where the benefit accrues primarily to society as a whole when a new practice is adopted. In North American usage, in American usage at any rate, social innovation is often used almost in conjunction with social entrepreneurship. It tends to highlight the role of an individual entrepreneur in a not-for-profit organization with some new idea that they're advancing. So kind of like the old technological innovation model, kind of like that Schumpeterian view. In European usage, there's a much greater emphasis on the collective aspects of social innovation. So I wanted to highlight that here because it's especially relevant to our case. So the European Commission, based on a number of reviews on advice from academic councils, has adopted a definition that social innovation is new ideas that simultaneously meet social needs and trigger new social relationships or collaborations. So not just that there's a benefit to society, but there's a change change in social relations. And other writers have taken that further. You see the definitions here, new rules for the social game of collaboration and contract and conflict. That's an interesting way to think about social innovation. And finally, I particularly like the last definition here, new social practices created from collective, intentional, and goal-oriented actions aimed at prompting social change. So if you're thinking, what's a social innovation? A new practice that has the effect of benefiting society and changing social relations, but in line with this last definition here, that is intended from the outset to have the effect of changing social relations. So you can think about a variety of things if you want to imagine examples. People will commonly talk about the introduction of microfinance as an example of social innovation. The introduction and spread of supported employment, of fair trade. So you can think about new practices, new ideas that change social relations and are intended to do so. So that's what social innovation is about. And in reviewing the literature on this subject, we actually found that those approaches to social innovation that emphasize institutionalist thinking, what are the institutions in society, how are they influenced, affected by social innovation, how do they condition it, are particularly relevant. And we have in Canada a group of scholars based mainly in Montreal who have developed their ideas around this. They're associated with the Centre for Research on Innovation and Social Economy at the University of Quebec in Montreal. It's called CRIS after the French acronym. And we found their approaches to this are especially useful. So that's a digest on the subject of social innovation, and happy to go into that more in the question period if people are interested. So given all that, let's return to our conceptual model of innovation here. So if we start to fold in the ideas of social innovation, Marie Bouchard has made the point that an important agent of social innovation over the last 200 years has been the social economy, cooperatives and community-based enterprises. And that often in the social economy, the entrepreneurship that occurs is a collective or group entrepreneurship rather than individual. So one change when we start to include social innovation in the picture is that we think about civil society groups and collectivities as agents, as the entrepreneurs, if you like, but as the actors who are driving innovation. It's also the case that, of course, we're not necessarily talking about technology. We're talking about social changes, changes in behaviors that spread, and they spread with different constraints and different drivers. It's not all about economics when you start to include social innovation. Cognitive elements. When we think about what impulse causes these groups to conduct, to implement a social innovation, it doesn't seem likely that it's things like factor-price relations that we see in the economic theory. So based on thinking about the German example, what my collaborator and I have been considering is that we might think about ideas of cognitive dissonance. So thinking of Festinger, classic writer on the subject in the 1950s. So cognitive dissonance arises when there's a conflict in a person within a person in their thinking between values that are at odds with each other, or a conflict between their values and their experiences of their actions and their participation in society. And as you'll see, we think this is actually a pretty good fit to describe what motivates the people who have created these energy cooperatives and who have driven the energy transformation forward in Germany, is a cognitive dissonance between the values they hold, the kind of society they want to live in, and their personal experience of their role in the energy system. If you accept that framework, then the outcome of an innovation process, if you act on dissonance, what people act to do is to reduce or eliminate the dissonance, and the outcome then is something like a cognitive harmony, where values or one's experiences are brought more into accord with each other. And what will drive this then will be values, will be knowledge, might be risk awareness, but certainly much more than prices. So that's the cognitive piece that we're looking at including in the model. When we think about the diffusion part, it's also very interesting to think in relation to a case like energy cooperatives about diffusion not being a passive process where people simply choose to adopt an innovation or not. So in Rogers's model, that's pretty much all it is, that people either accept the innovation, they're an early adopter, or they drag their feet and they're a laggard. But there is some additional thinking that's been done by Eric von Hippel, who talked about the concept of user innovation and the ways in which innovations, once they get out there, start to be changed and adapted by the people who adopt them. So it's a much more active, much more participatory, more iterative kind of process. So we're thinking about how that might involve feedback loops within the process, where the innovation changes as more people get involved, and it isn't just the original actor, the entrepreneur in the Schumpeterian model who defines the innovation, but there's a whole community of people participating in defining it and shaping it. So as you'll see, that is especially relevant to the German case. So that's a dense, I apologize for that, that's a dense overview of some ideas about innovation that we've surveyed and some of the ways in which we see a concept of innovation might be laid out that helps explain examples like the German one. And so, in fact, it's so dense it's frozen the equipment. There we go. So given all that, what about the energy cooperatives? So let's think about the energy cooperatives and think about their story within the categories that we've defined as part of this model. So first of all, what is the impulse behind the energy cooperatives, behind the actors who have taken action to cause this particular change to occur? We have a number of clues, and again, I'd go back to this WBGU, the German Advisory Council report, which laid out a really interesting framework in a lengthy document. This is a report that's a couple of hundred pages long, and they have a really big discussion in it about values. So the WBGU, advising the German government, called for a worldwide remodeling of economy and society towards sustainability. And they conceptualized what's required for sustainability as a great transformation. And that phrase, great transformation, they cite Karl Polanyi and his work on the introduction of the industrial economy in the 19th century as a great transformation. They also cite, they see this as an emergent process, they also cite what they see as a gap between attitudes and behaviors. And that comment is really interesting to us when we think about cognitive dissonance and what drives people to act. So the gap between the attitudes that are emerging as part of this great transformation, between the values that are spreading, and the behaviors of what actually goes on in the energy sector. So that's a very suggestive comment. This report is especially interesting because it came out in March of 2011. And of course, something else happened in March of 2011 that had an enormous impact on public perceptions of energy in Germany, and that was the Fukushima disaster in Japan. So the WBGU report was almost all written by the time Fukushima happened, and the report in that way, the thinking in this report was independent, but clearly when it hit kind of public consciousness in Germany, Fukushima was a big deal. So a part of this process, the decision by the German population, by policymakers, by citizens, their active involvement to reshape the economy kind of paralleled being in favor of renewable energy and this growing drive to disinvest from nuclear energy. So in Germany, that's a huge part of the story. When we think about values, when we think about cognitive dissonance, that desire that crystallized in Germany over this period of time to exit from nuclear energy becomes an important part of the story. When we think about the values motivation at the very broad level, you can see in the public discourse in Germany how that evolved between 2000 and the present. If we now turn to look at who actually were the actors who did things to cause these citizen energy enterprises, these cooperatives to be created, a lot of our material here is based on a number of surveys that have been done by the German Cooperative Federation, the DGRV, and a number of other studies that have been done by researchers in Berlin, which have really asked the leaders of these cooperatives, have interviewed them, surveyed them, and analyzed their responses. And what we find is that the managers and the chairs in these cooperatives are strongly values-driven in their motivations. So when they're asked, why do you engage in this? Why is renewable energy important? Why do you commit to it? Their number one answer is, we need to promote renewable energy for the good of Germany and the world. Their number two answer is, we need to promote the creation of value in regions within Germany. So I want to come back to that in a minute. There's a really important regional dimension to what's going on here. There's a variety of other answers which were really quite distant from those two. So some of them said they sought to receive dividends from investing in these new technologies. Some of them said that they sought to reduce the costs of energy. But those things were way down on the list. So it's really clear that the people driving these projects are driven strongly by these values concepts. Some of the research also suggests that the leaders in these cooperatives are more strongly driven by values than their members are. So that's an important thing to keep in mind and an interesting dynamic. So the people who are causing it to happen, they're doing it to change the world, to change Germany and more. The members may be quite interested in that dividend. So that's an interesting dynamic to consider as we go. So that's a little bit about the impulse that causes people to take action. So who are the people who take action? What do we know about them? So again, thinking about these cooperatives, what we know is that the vast majority of the members are private citizens. So individual people with some qualifications, but people like you and me. Interestingly, though, and this is significant out of proportion to the numbers, some of the members of these cooperatives are also institutional or business members. So about 3% of the members are businesses or banks. Many of those are cooperative banks, financial cooperatives. 3% of the members are farmers, and actually the biogas installations are driven by farmers in many cases. 2% of the members are public entities, municipal governments, boards and agencies, and things of that kind. So although there's this, 160,000 individuals who've put up their money, bought their shares, joined these cooperatives, these institutional members regionally play a significant role. What we know about the individual members, you can see on the overhead, so they're disproportionately men, they're disproportionately middle-aged, disproportionately well-educated, disproportionately people with high incomes. So these are people with resources to commit to a cause, right? But maybe the most interesting thing is that 80% of them are active in other civil economy organizations, other civil society organizations. So these are people who are networked. They're people who know organizations, who know people, who are active in organizations. So this is that social economy dimension and that more networked, more group phenomenon becoming evident. It's also really interesting that the patterns of what organizations they're active in differ immensely from one region to another. So you can't say that, it's the members of Association X in all regions of Germany who've gone out to help form these cooperatives. It's different associations in every place. But what's in common is that the people who do this are networked and are active in civil society. So that's a little bit of what we know about who the actors are, and it relates a bit to that social innovation idea. What kind of invention is going on here? Maybe just to highlight, and this is a critical part of the story, there is some implementation of new technology going on here. So part of this story is about technology. However, it's also a new structure of industry, going from concentrated power production, where four companies produced most of the power in Germany, to a decentralized structure of the industry where many, many more players are involved and on smaller and more regional basis. It's also a new governance and new roles for people in society. So it used to be in Germany, this is 15 years ago, that to be a power producer meant that you were a big company. But now, consumers are also producers, and we sort of have that blending of roles and that dual roles going on with a new governance that individual people who never were part of the power production or distribution system before are now members. They attend annual meetings, they elect people to boards, they sit on boards. So there's a new governance here as well. It's also new to have enterprises in this sector that have mixed objectives, as these ones do. So there are dividends from these cooperatives. There's an economic role to what they do. But clearly, when people join them, when they pay a premium for their power or when they accept a lower rate of return on their investment than they might get from the stock market, part of the return they're getting is a values-based return. It's a satisfaction. So you have enterprises that are delivering economic returns, new technology, but also satisfaction and values and a sense of achievement. And of course, new forms of incorporation. I want to say a word in a moment about that. It isn't incorporating cooperatives for energy is a brand new idea. And in fact, these aren't typical cooperatives. So now if you step back and say, which of these changes was foreseen in advance by those who drafted the legislation? Really, the EEG, the Renewable Energy Law, only specified the first of these. Everything else is what has emerged and developed as the process has unfolded through the engagement of civil society and the things that people have done and found ways to do as they implemented this new model. It's interesting to think about costs and conflicts that are involved in this process. So just think about the economics for a moment. The average individual member of these cooperatives is putting in about 3,600, 3,700 euros in investment. And in general, what they're getting back is nearly 4% in dividends on that investment. So you can think of this as being like a social share, that it gives a financial return as well as a social return to the individual members who join the co-ops. On average, the co-ops have raised about 2.2 million euros per co-op. The member capital in the system is over 400 million euros. And of course, the co-ops use the member capital to leverage additional financing from other investors and institutions. So the total investment in the cooperatives is something in the order of 1.7 billion euros. So a substantial, so you can think about this from the point of view of economic viability and cost. There's a substantial investment that's been made. Members are getting returns. That's making sense to them, because of the combination of financial and values-based returns. But while the economics have not proven to be a barrier to the development of the cooperatives, what has proven to be a barrier is politics, or small p politics, if I can say that. If you think back to that Schumpeterian idea that the spread of new things causes disruptions, and add to it the idea that disruptions cause pushbacks. So that's what's been going on in Germany in the last 2 years. So there's two areas of tension in this kind of policy. One is over the sharing of costs and the perception that whether households are paying their fair share or are paying too much compared to the taxpayer and compared to industry. So as the costs have been borne, there's been some pushback about the total cost of the whole transformation. Land use, however, is also a really interesting conflict that comes up when these cooperatives are developed. Whether it's wind or solar, or maybe most acutely with biogas, the presence of the cooperative changes the aesthetics, it changes the appearance of the landscape, and there's people who don't like that, there's people who push back against that. And that's a phenomenon not just for the co-ops, but for everybody. But as a result of pushback around a variety of features, the EEG, the enabling law here, the framework, has been revised in 2014 and 2016 in ways that are actually disadvantageous to further cooperatives being formed. So the certainty of the economic returns has been reduced. That makes it harder for local people who are not wealthy, who are not business people, to risk their investment. And also, there's been a tendering process introduced, mandated by the EU. This wasn't desired by Germany, but there's been a tendering process introduced that requires community groups to submit very complex documents in order to be considered for new production. So the two barriers of the changes in the premiums and the changes in the process to introduce tendering have really restricted the development of further cooperatives in the last couple of years. So you do see a classic Rogersian logistic distribution curve when you look at the cumulative number of energy cooperatives founded since 2006. But what's causing that curve to level off is not that every town in Germany now has an energy co-op. It's not that everyone who wants to form one has formed one. What's causing it to level off is the policy environment and the institutional environment. And so the movement in Germany is now needing to take stock of what happens next and what model will be compatible with this system. The theme of conflict also has something to say to the question of why people have used cooperatives as part of this process. So when my colleague and I, when we think about this, you know, no one prescribed that German citizens should form co-ops. Yes, it was intended that people would put up wind parks and solar arrays, but no one actually said go out and form co-ops. The co-op movement didn't particularly promote the idea to begin with. And there's some ways in which it's an awkward fit with what these particular social actors are doing. But one of the things that we think, based on the examples we've looked at, is that locally owned cooperatives have proven to be particularly good ways of managing the local conflicts that have arisen around energy production. So within communities where there are suspicions about the costs or the benefits, where there's a reluctance to have something located in one's own backyard, where there's a pushback against an outside investor coming into the community and changing the landscape, it makes it easier if the local people have a stake, if they're actually the investors, if they're the owners, if they share the profits. It reduces some of those tensions and it eliminates some of the suspicions. And in a number of cases in Germany that people have looked at, there's a couple of features of the cooperative model that proved especially conducive to resolving conflicts at the community level. One is that cooperatives are traditionally pledged, and these cooperatives are, to open membership. So it's not just one group of people who start putting up a plant and no one else can get in on it. If you want in on it, you can join. It's open to everyone in the community. You have the opportunity to invest just like your neighbors. And in cooperatives, a defining feature of primary cooperatives is one member, one vote. So the control is shared in an egalitarian fashion. So that appears to help defuse many of the conflicts that arise. There's a number of pieces of evidence of this. There's a study that was done in 2011 that compared two villages in Saxony. One of the villages had an energy cooperative. The other one had a private developer energy company. And in looking at the attitudes of the citizens, the residents in the co-op community were three times more accepting of wind energy than the residents in the community where the wind installation was privately owned. Similarly, a study by Becker and colleagues really saw that the choice of organizational forms seemed to be determined by local conflicts. And a number of choice experiments that have been conducted also show that German consumers generally are willing to pay more for energy that comes from a cooperative or from a municipally owned power producer. So really suggesting there's more acceptance of those ownership models than of other models. So we think, conflict is a critical part of the story. It explains the limitations in the spread of this new innovation, but it also helps explain why it took the form of co-ops as it spread in these communities. So we understand the cooperatives in this story as an example of user innovations where actors in society picked up on an idea that was out there and found their own way to implement it. And I will say briefly that in German cooperative law in particular, the idea is deeply embedded that co-ops promote the economic strength of their members. The co-op does business with its members. The co-op makes the members stronger by doing business with them. That's really strongly entrenched in the law. And that does not apply very well at all to solar arrays or wind parks because they are required under this regime to sell their energy into the network. So in fact, the people who join these cooperatives cannot, as things have stood, receive their energy from the cooperative they own. The biogas is different, by the way. There's local heating networks that are more like traditional cooperatives. So the members, when you think about it, they are producers and consumers of electricity, but they're not consumers of the electricity that they're producing. And their relationship then, their benefit that they're getting from the cooperative is a dividend and the satisfaction of participating in an economic transformation. That's not the classic German model of a cooperative. So these people actually took an available form of incorporation, a number of whose features fit what they wanted to do, and they implemented it in a way that actually was not intended, certainly by the German cooperative law, probably not intended by the German cooperative movement. So this is a really interesting part of the story. The role of these businesses, banks, and farmers as members in these enterprises alongside consumers is also an important innovation. That turns these into multi-stakeholder cooperatives. And you can imagine, you know, the People's Bank, the Volksbank in the local town being a member of the co-op. That's just one member in the statistics. But if you think about the role of that financial cooperative in legitimating the new energy cooperative, probably in lending money to it, in giving it business connections, the institutional members of these cooperatives are playing roles out of proportion to their numbers. So the innovation, I suppose, that is represented by these cooperatives is what I'd call value-based community-embedded enterprises, which is not something we've seen in the energy sector in recent years in countries like Germany. And the regional role of these, I think, is maybe a major point I want to dwell on for a moment. The fact that they're owned within a small region, most of them are rural, they're owned within a small region, the share owners live in the same community, the profits are kept in the community, the dividends are distributed in the community. The co-ops make a point of hiring local tradespeople to work on their projects. So the project actually has acquired a really important community economic development character in regions of rural Germany where these cooperatives are active. So this is an example of that. This is a model energy cooperative. This is based in the region of the Odenwald, which is a rural region, say an hour south of Frankfurt, founded in 2009 by 3,000 individual members. And you see in the photograph there one of what's now 80 photovoltaic installations that they have, this cooperative producing 6.5 megawatts from solar power. But the regional development dimension is really interesting. So for their office, they bought an abandoned brewery and renovated it. They turned the brewery into a community facility, a kind of hub for the community. They assembled in the community, invited in every office and agency that has to do with energy and construction that they could find in that area. So the municipal permitting office is located in their building. Architectural firms, consultants, advisors, construction tradespeople have offices in their building. So they've turned it into an economic center for all kinds of construction and energy-related activity. It also is a center for civic events, for educational events. They have conference facilities, catering facilities, so really reinvigorating the community in all variety of ways. They moved the municipal kindergarten into their facility and renovated it and created new spaces for the kids. And of course, they have photovoltaic installations all over the place. This is on the municipal parking lot in Erbach, where you can see they've covered the roof of the car park with solar panels. So that may give you a little bit of a sense of a rural example. I don't want to take the time to delve into this. I did just want to say there are also urban examples. This is an example of a housing cooperative in Heidelberg that is looking at how to install solar panels on its roof and share that power with itself and among its houses before putting it into the net. So they're actually trying to figure out a system, and they have regulatory issues to address of how to directly consume their own power and not simply sell into the net. So there are urban examples as well. So in terms of coming to a conclusion here, I would say that in developing the model that we have of what innovation looks like when you synthesize technological and social innovation, we find that's really helpful for understanding this example. It highlights the fact that the actors in the process, the innovators as well as the adapters or adopters, have a very strong values motivation. That, as much as economics or the legal regime, is what's propelling this forward. We see the role of civil society actors, of people who are networked in organizations at the local level, the importance of conflicts and how they're resolved, innovations in by users, and innovations in governance. It is also a good opportunity to reflect on what Canada could learn from this, and I'll maybe just skip to that. So we do also revise our model to build in conflict and some iterative features. But let me just reflect a bit. So what could Canada learn from looking at the German example? So first of all, a transformation of this kind, certainly the German case, is driven strongly by values. So that attention to values, what values motivate the actors, what things are valued by the population that participates, that accepts, that pays, are critical features of the story. The law by itself, the premiums by themselves, the actions of entrepreneurs, the technology by itself does not animate this story. It's with the ingredient of values added in that the whole thing is propelled forward. Similarly, of course, the institutional environment matters, federal legal framework and regulatory issues, even international regulatory issues, but also the local institutional environment that surrounds each and every one of these cooperatives. And I would observe that that role of values and of institutions in this story also makes it unlikely that another country like Canada could simply copy what Germany has done and implement it here. It would have to be tailored to our own values and our own institutions. But we can see the dynamics in the German case, and it might be an interesting point for the discussion period, what might a Canadian equivalent look like. It's clear that this scale of transformation in a case like Germany's is not driven by business alone, not by legislation alone, also not by civil society alone. It's the coordinated approach across all of those that's produced the result we see in Germany. This is a synthesis of technological and social innovation. There are different practices, different concepts, different behaviors at the local level in villages throughout Germany that sustain this transformation. We need to allow for a user innovation, that should read, and for local dynamics in rolling out these systems, not think of them as cookie cutters, and to expect conflict and plan for how to manage it. So those might be a few high-level takeaways, and I'm sure there are others that will occur to many of you in the audience in Regina and in Saskatoon. So that was the end of what I prepared. Thank you. Would be delighted to hear questions and reactions.